Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. You are not alone.
So Haley is a licensed professional counselor and a freelance writer in Oklahoma. She has co-authored a textbook chapter for mental health clinicians on helping secular individuals navigate grief, and has also written over 350 articles for a satirical sociopolitical website. In her free time, she also co-hosts a board game podcast and officiates secular and LGBTQ+ communities. That is like how my brain works. Weddings. So, Haley, let me unmute you. And thank you so much for being here today and taking the time to do all the, you know, behind the scenes work, and also just for being here today to share all your amazing knowledge with us.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me back. I had so much fun last time, and I'm grateful to be a part of this. This is such a wonderful organization. You all work very hard to put this all together. So thank you guys for doing this every week.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you, really. So I know that you have a few slides.
Awesome. So, like Ms. Amaya said, feel free to type any questions in the chat box. We'll have time for questions and answers at the end there. But the topic for today is suffering and martyrdom, coexisting with life. So who is that squirrely girly? That is me. My name is Haley Twyman Brack. So a little bit about me. I am a licensed professional counselor in Oklahoma. I am also a part of the Secular Therapy Project. So along with religious and secular issues, I work primarily with grief, trauma, and suicidal ideation. I also do a lot of continuing education seminars for clinicians on secularism, ethics, and millennial mental health. I've also do some side projects now. I've been teaching a little class on rage quitting and board gaming, which has been fun. So in my spare time, like Amaya said, I am a freelance writer. I do a board game themed podcast, and I am a secular wedding officiant. And I used to be a Catholic. I'm now a recovering Catholic, and I identify as a secular humanist. So just want to do a quick disclosure here. This presentation is for education and fun, not for mental health or medical advice. If you or a loved one ever experience a mental health or other emergency, please go to your nearest ER, call 911. They'll take good care of you. If you'd like to find mental health care for yourself, please go to seculartherapy.org or findcbt.org. Both of those organizations have a great database of secular and evidence-based counselors near you. And so please hit those websites up. So, disclosure, we will have time for questions at the end of the presentation, and I will ask general or educational questions. I can't give mental health advice, so mental health advice will not be given. I would be a horrible Dr. Phil. If a personal or mental health question is asked, I will refer you to consult with your own mental health clinician. And so nothing said today should replace mental health or other medical care. I am not a doctor, nor do I play one on TV. This is all for fun and games, my friends. All right, so just a quick outline for what we will be covering today. We're going to talk about religious perspectives on suffering. We're going to talk about how, spoiler alert, suffering can be helpful in some circumstances. We're also going to talk about how suffering can be unhelpful and ways to coexist with suffering, because suffering is a part of human life. So there's a really neat article that's linked here, and I sent my slides to Amaya to add to the database. So if anyone wants the slides or the handouts to this, all of my resources are here and hyperlinked in my article. But I found this really neat article that outlines religious stances on suffering. Now, this is very basic. I don't have a religious studies degree like my atheist husband does. And so I'm just going to go over each of these basic explanations of suffering. And so with Judaism, according to this article, suffering is seen as a fact of life or sometimes a punishment for turning away from God. Buddhism, humans can create their own suffering, but suffering can be a good teacher. Catholicism, suffering means we are sharing Christ's work and that we have a purpose. Christianity, suffering may enhance life, especially when done for others. And Islam, suffering is unavoidable in life, but may lead to good rewards. Now, again, this is a very basic explanation of suffering, and individuals within those religions or coming from those religions may have different perspectives, but I just thought it'd be a neat idea just to include those different perspectives and show how suffering can be used in different kinds of religions or is presented in that way. So, Paul, can suffering be healthy? So I see the answers here. We have 40% say yes, 26% say no, and 34% say I don't know. And so I know I've already spoiled that one a little bit in saying that suffering can be healthy. So let's talk about meaningful suffering for a moment. So the research suggests that suffering can, in some circumstances, lead to positive outcomes like psychological growth. So when we think about trauma, whenever I think about trauma treatment, one of the major components is not just, you know, what happened to you or, you know, when did that happen? It's how do we get through? What strengths did we rely on? You know, was it our resilience? Was it our intelligence? Was it our cunningness? You know, what brought us through all those years in recovering? Was it our support system? Was it, you know, what was it? And so sometimes whenever we go through a traumatic event, if we can identify what kinds of strengths have brought us through, that can lead to, that can bring meaning from the event. The same thing with grief. When we talk about grief, whether that is grief from losing a loved one or losing a job or, you know, a miscarriage, anything like that, there is kind of a reshuffling of our life that happens whenever we experience any kind of grief. And so with grief, we it's a time for us to reevaluate our values, what's important in our life. And so grief can bring about a meaningful suffering, you know, after we've processed the emotions or while we're processing the emotions. And the research suggests that finding meaning in suffering may reduce distress. Now, for some, religion is helpful for that, but not for all. Sometimes, as we'll talk about, religion can actually use suffering in a negative way. But stress in general may be healthy. When we think about positive stress, motivating stress, like if I wasn't stressed for my finals in college, I probably would not have studied. Like that's a good example of motivating stress. I'm sure that we've all experienced at some point in our life. And same thing with positive stress. When we exercise, that is stress we're putting on our body, but that's a positive, healthy stress. And so when we think about stress, we think about suffering, it's not always a negative thing, but it can be used in a negative way. So let's talk about unhelpful suffering. So we're going to discuss martyrdom, negative suffering, and developing negative core beliefs, as well as a phenomenon called pathological altruism. So martyrdom. So martyrdom is known as self-induced suffering or self-sacrifice. In the research, the martyrdom effect shows that experiencing pain and suffering leads people to give more meaning to pro-social behaviors. That means that the more we believe our acts are charitable and good for others, the more willing we are to suffer. Did you all know that we can raise money for organizations without having to wake up at 5 a.m. to run a 5K? We can just give our money. We don't have to wake up at 5 a.m. to run a 5K, but we do. Why is that? I read the study and it blew my mind. I'd never thought of it that way. Like, we don't have to run a 5K, but for some reason, if we believe that our acts cause us to suffer more, we believe for some reason that they're more charitable or good for others, which is why so many of our walkathons and 5Ks are so popular for raising money for charity instead of just giving money. But martyrdom can also lead to things like poor boundaries. So thinking that we have to sacrifice ourselves for others in order to be a good friend, which we'll discuss in a little more detail later. Martyrdom, you know, it can be celebrated in multiple religions. I remember growing, I was raised strict Catholic. And one of the best arguments I heard was Jesus died for your sins so you can wake up for 8 a.m. Mass on Sunday. Ugh. So the sacrificing of yourself, and that's a really light way to put it, but oftentimes religions might use it to pressure us into giving more resources, giving more time. The belief that sacrifice and suffering will inevitably lead to reward in the afterlife. Some religions may also say that sacrifice and suffering is necessary to repent for sins or repent for wrongdoings. I remember in the Catholic faith, you know, you would go to confession and then the priest would assign you a form of penance, which whenever you're 8 might look like, say, 10 Hail Marys. Whenever you're older, it might look like volunteering for the church to make up for your sins. Like there's this belief that you have to suffer in order to make up for what you've done wrong in your life. Which, spoiler alert, can lead to us believing that whenever we're suffering, that means that we've done something wrong. Oh, fun fact, penitentiary comes from the term penance. I recently learned that as well. And so when we think about penance, paying for your sins, penitentiary, and prison reform is a thing that we need. Anyway, moving on, martyrdom. So martyrdom, again, is believing that martyrdom or self-inflicted suffering is good may lead us to accept more of it or even seek it out. So if we believe that the more we suffer, the more good we're doing, we might start seeking out more suffering, might start seeking out more pain. And this can lead to the development of what's called unhelpful core beliefs. So let's talk about core beliefs. So core beliefs are main ideas about ourselves, others, and the world around us. They're kind of like a pair of sunglasses. So if I'm wearing rose-colored glasses and someone else is wearing green-colored glasses, we might be looking at the same object, but we see kind of different things. And so core beliefs, they can be helpful, they can be unhelpful. They may not always be accurate or logical, but they typically develop during early childhood experiences and times of stress. So let's look at different kinds of core beliefs. So if I have the core belief of, my core belief is nobody likes me. Let's say I go to a party during non-COVID times, and I have the core belief about myself that nobody likes me. I might think to myself, nobody really wants to talk to me. They don't really want to get to know me. They don't even like that I'm here. So I might have those thoughts, which might lead to behaviors of I don't really talk to people. I withdraw. I might sit in the corner, be a wallflower. And the consequence of that is that I don't really make any friends. And because I don't really make any friends, that reinforces that core belief that, hey, nobody likes me. Whereas if I have a core belief of I'm likable, I might go to this party and I might talk to people. No, I might not make friends with everybody, but I'm probably going to come away with at least a few acquaintances there. And so that's going to reinforce the belief that I'm likable. And so core beliefs, they can be positive or negative, but sometimes the belief, this martyrdom belief can lead to what's called negative or unhelpful core beliefs. So let's say that through growing up in a religious environment, have internalized the core belief that suffering is punishment. Anytime that I'm suffering, it's because I've done something wrong. If I have this core belief, something activates that core belief, I experience suffering. My thought might be, I must have done something to deserve this. I start to feel guilty. And so I might do something to make up for it. I might obsessively start doing good deeds. You know, if I feel like I've offended somebody, I might loosen up my boundaries. I might sacrifice more of myself there, or I might engage in something called pathological altruism, which we'll get into. So let's define pathological altruism versus altruism. So altruism is helping others at a cost to oneself. It is considered to be healthy or pro-social behavior, and it binds us together. So altruism is a good thing. Now, if we look at it from an evolutionary psychology perspective, we are hardwired to want to help people. Like our reward pathways are activated whenever we do something good for someone. Like we volunteer at a shelter, we get groceries for an elderly neighbor or anything like that. Anytime we do something out of the kindness of our heart, we do have those reward pathways activated. Altruism is good and it helps others and it helps our community. However, there's a difference between altruism and pathological altruism. So pathogenic guilt means erroneously believing that we've caused something bad to happen, like suffering in others or suffering in ourselves, and we have the ability to fix it. And sometimes this develops through trauma, religious or otherwise. We see this a lot in survivor's guilt. So let's say that there's been a 9/11, a terrorist attack, September 11, 2001. You saw a lot of individuals develop survivor's guilt where they felt like they don't deserve to be alive. There's some sort of meaning attached to it. And so a lot of times people with survivor's guilt, it's not a lot of times, but it's not uncommon for them to have poor mental health, engage in self-harm in some way. So this pathological guilt can lead to what's called pathological altruism, which is altruistic behavior that hurts no one or hurts the altruist or helps no one. And so Pathological altruism, what that is it can be self-sabotaging behaviors, like intentionally causing our own suffering, such as self-harm. It can lead to a reinforcement of the self-blaming core beliefs. So if we feel better after engaging in pathological altruism because it feels good, it must be working, right? And so it could reinforce the core belief of if I suffer, it's because I've done something wrong. I deserve to suffer. And so it can also lead to difficulty in setting boundaries with others out of guilt, because if we're setting boundaries, we believe we're causing suffering to others. So in conclusion, martyrdom, stress, or other traumatic experiences can lead to the development of unhelpful core beliefs, such as I deserve to suffer. Unhelpful core beliefs can lead to this erroneous or pathological guilt. This guilt can drive some of us to engage in pathological altruism, which can be anything from self-harm, harming ourselves, self-sabotage, to other things like loose boundaries or porous boundaries. And this pathological altruism feels good. Like even though this altruism is hurting us, it feels good to us. It still activates these neural pathways that feel good, which may help to reinforce these negative core beliefs that this martyrdom, this suffering, this suffering, this self-sacrifice is good. Any questions on that so far?
There was one question that was kind of answered already, but I'm just going to ask it to be annoying. So no. Someone asked, when you talk about self-inflicted suffering, does this include physical suffering, like self-harming behavior?
Yes. So it can be self-harming, whether that be physical self-harm in some ways. It could also be things we've seen restricting food, restricting water in that way is often something that is overlooked. And so it can be restricting things that are pleasurable for ourselves as well. And so, it can, the self-harm, it can be self-sabotaging behavior, self-sabotaging a good thing that's going for us, or it can be the act of physical self-harm.
Perfect. Thank you.
Of course. Well, this is my favorite part of the presentation, is how we coexist with suffering. Because like we said, suffering is a part of life. Everyone suffers at times. And through trauma, whether that be religious or otherwise, sometimes that suffering is internalized as punishment. And so it's very difficult to go through day by day thinking that whenever we experience a negative event that we have in some way deserve it, whenever that's not true. And so we're going to talk about some ways using therapists and not using therapists that we can start to learn how to coexist with suffering. And so how do we coexist with suffering? So what we can do is we can find meaning in the suffering. We can set healthy boundaries with others. We can consider our values and we can examine our core beliefs. So the first thing we can do is find meaning. So finding meaning in suffering may help to reduce the suffering-related stress. So again, in doing so, we can identify the strengths we've developed and relied on, rather than focusing on what did suffering do to me, reflect on how did I make it through. So I'm sure we can think about, you know, I think about this self-esteem workbook that I use a lot with kids. And we think about self-esteem are, what are some like positive things that have improved your self-esteem? You know, what did your parents tell you when you were a kid? Or what was this award you won in middle school? But the self-esteem book, I really love it because it also prompts them to think about negative events that positively impacted our self-esteem. Because I'm sure we can all think about times in our life where we've overcome adversity and like, man, you know, that moment sucked. It really sucked. 2020 sucked. But guys, we made it through. How did we do it? How did we do it? So taking time to reflect on, you know, what did I overcome? You know, what kind of knowledge did this suffering bring? What did I rely on? What skills did I develop to overcome 2020? We all had to learn how to adapt. So we can all add that to our resume that we are very adaptable creatures. And so when we find meaning in suffering, you know, this can be something that you do through journaling. It can also be something that you do through a therapist. And again, plug the Secular Therapy Project. I know I'm biased because I'm registered with them, but I also got my own personal therapist through the Secular Therapy Project, and she's awesome. So Secular Therapy Project, find an awesome therapist to kind of explore this with. But yeah, sometimes finding meaning, whether that is strengths or whether that is something core about ourselves that we discovered through the suffering, sometimes that can be helpful in alleviating that suffering-related stress. So for our poll question, is suffering always bad or selfishness always bad? I apologize. So 1% said yes, 91% said no, and 8% said, I don't know. So let's take a gander at this year. So it can be healthy to be selfish. So we often think about selfishness in a negative way. Like, and of course, you know, with kindergartners who don't have theory of mind, who don't have the ability to see themselves in someone else's shoes, we're like, okay, don't be selfish. You can't hog all the toys. You can only play with one at a time. Like from a young age, we're kind of taught not to be selfish, but in some ways, selfishness can be healthy as well. Selfishness is preservation. If we weren't a little bit selfish, we'd never feed ourselves. We wouldn't, you know, take time to rest. And so when we talk about suffering and this pathological altruism, you know, one of the things that often happens with pathological altruism is difficulty setting boundaries. You know, if we believe we have wronged somebody, or we believe we have to make up for something wrong that we've done because of suffering, well, that might lead us to have difficulty setting boundaries with somebody. We might give too much of ourselves to, in the past, the church or to other people. And so when it comes to setting boundaries, like this can be helpful in breaking that pathological altruism because we're taking care of ourselves. We're still being altruistic and helping others. We're just recognizing, you know, what is that healthy place for us? And so there's lots of different kinds of boundaries I like to talk about. So first of all, boundaries are yours and yours alone. Something to keep in mind whenever we are breaking the pattern of pathological altruism is that just because we are setting a boundary for ourselves, it doesn't mean that we're doing it to somebody else. Because sometimes it feels that way. You know, sometimes if you say, no, I can't let you borrow my car this weekend, or I'm sorry, I can't spare you that 50 bucks, it feels like we're doing that to the other person. It feels like we're spiting them some way, but really we're just setting that boundary for ourselves. And when we think about boundaries, you know, my boundaries might look very different from your boundaries. I often do an exercise with my little kid clients. I see like half kid clients, half adults, but I do an exercise where we have a hula hoop around us and not in COVID times. But with my little kid clients, like, okay, my boundary is my hula hoop. You can't come closer to my hula hoop. Some people's hula hoops are right up against their belly. Some people's hula hoops are way out here. But you have to respect wherever their hula hoops are, and you can't get closer to them. So I use that a lot, especially with group settings, to teach little kids about boundaries. But it's the same for us. All of our boundaries are different. And so we can all probably recognize whenever our boundaries are starting to be violated. And like I said, there's different kinds of boundaries. So physical boundaries, like how close are you to me? Intellectual boundaries. You know, what am I willing to argue about on Facebook? I had to set a more rigid psychological or intellectual boundary a few years ago when Trump was elected. Was healthy for me. Emotional boundaries. What am I willing to share with others? And what am I willing to take on? You know, oftentimes what we see in pathological altruism is with emotional boundaries, we have a very rigid emotional boundary for ourselves, so we don't share our problems with others, but we might be that friend who everybody calls for help. We take on everybody else's emotions, and, you know, that might feel good. We have that altruism going on. We're helping our friend, but after a while, that's not really healthy for us. We also talk about sexual boundaries. You know, what are you comfortable with your sexuality? Material boundaries. What objects, what money are you willing to share and not share? And then time boundaries. How much of your time are you willing to dedicate to people? And so part of breaking that pathological altruism, again, is setting a healthy boundary for ourselves. And, you know, you might have a more porous boundary in one area or a rigid boundary in another, and that's okay. My healthy boundary might look porous to you. Your healthy boundary might look rigid to me. It's all about just respecting your own boundaries, not changing them for someone else. And so after we consider our boundaries, we also want to consider our values. So acceptance and commitment therapy theory is an amazing theory for psychology. Basically, it combines a mindfulness approach, more of a secular Buddhist philosophy approach, with cognitive behavioral therapy, which is an evidence-based practice. And just, I just want to read you a few quotes from the manual. So to create a rich, full, and meaningful life while accepting the pain that inevitably goes along with it, even in the midst of a tremendous pain and suffering, there's an opportunity to find meaning, purpose, and vitality. So the reason why I really like the acceptance and commitment therapy approach is because it's very hopeful, but at the same time, not ignoring suffering, because suffering happens. And so rather than living to avoid suffering, what it wants us to do is identify and live toward our values. So let's talk about values for a second. So, you know, with acceptance and commitment therapy, you know, it posits that the more that we try to push away or avoid suffering, the more we're going to suffer. Because if we're spending all of our time trying to avoid anxiety or avoid depression, well, that's just futile. Because depression, anxiety, sadness, grief, those are part of the human experience and they happen. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with us. It just means that we're human beings, as far as I know. And so with acceptance commitment therapy, what you do is instead of living to avoid suffering, we identify our values. So let's say, for example, I value my family 10 out of 10. That is my top value. I love my niece. I love my husband. I love my fur children. And let's say if I value that value 10 out of 10, but every day I am staying 2 to 3 hours late at work, I'm taking work phone calls during dinner, I am taking my friend's phone call, this is supposed to be family time, you know, that might be altruistic. I'd be giving myself to work, I'd be giving myself to my friends, but that's being harmful to me. You know, and I'm not living like I value my family at a 10 by a 10. I'm living like I value my family at a 3 or a 4. And so with values-based living, it's identifying what our values are and really living by them and looking at the actions that align with them. So maybe if I valued my family at 10 by a 10, I'd have a healthy boundary between work and home. I wouldn't take friends' phone calls whenever it's family movie night. And so a big component of values-based living is setting boundaries in those other areas. You know, if we find that there's an area of our life where we're giving so much, we're engaging in that pathological altruism, to take a step back and say, okay, is this does feel good? Yes. But is this healthy for me? And why am I doing this? Because oftentimes when we set boundaries, we find that their relationships are healthier in the long run. There's a really awesome book called The Happiness Trap by Russ Harris, which is a book for, it's not for clinicians, it's for just all of us. And so if you're really interested in learning how to live with suffering rather than learning how to avoid it, I really recommend that book. It's very good too. And his humor, he has great humor and great dad jokes. So if you're a fan of humor and dad jokes, highly recommend that. And so I just wanted to go through some of the components of now. So again, with ACT, a big component is learning to live with suffering. And so because suffering happens every day, we suffer in some way. And so in order to live with suffering, we want to engage, we want to contact the present moment through mindfulness. The research suggests that mindfulness is really helpful in improving what's called psychological flexibility. Psychological flexibility is our ability to adapt whenever we're having good moments to bad moments, whenever we're experiencing adversity throughout the day, whenever we've hit our 15th red light on the way to the doctor's appointment, being able to stay mindful and present in the moment without it completely ruining our day. Also, it includes acceptance. So allowing emotions to come and go. We might experience things like anxiety, like sadness, like suffering, like frustration. And accepting that the suffering that comes with life, it just comes with life. It doesn't mean anything about us. It doesn't mean that we've done anything to deserve this hardship. It doesn't mean that we've done anything to deserve this pain. It just means that these emotions, these feelings, these experiences come and go, and practice allowing those experiences to come so we can experience the happy moments on the other side. Another component is diffusion, not taking all thoughts as truth. We talked a little bit in my previous presentation about how we have 40 to 60,000 thoughts per day, which is a lot of thoughts. And though we have so many thoughts, and a lot of those thoughts can lead to anxiety, depression, everything in between, not all of those thoughts are true. And so a big component of ACT is learning how to be mindful when those thoughts are coming, accepting those thoughts, acknowledging them, but not taking them as truth. Just because we have the thought that I must have done something to deserve this suffering, it doesn't mean that it is true. We even have to pay it any mind. The next part is self as context, recognizing that our body, emotion, environments are changing, but we are still us. There's a really great metaphor in the ACT book by Russ Harris that says that we are like the sky, and suffering is like the clouds in the sky. When we look up and we see the sky, we might see the clouds. It doesn't mean that the sky is still not there. Eventually, the clouds will pass. We just have to remember that the sky is still there. And we kind of have to think about that as suffering. You know, just because we are going through suffering, it doesn't mean that we have change. It doesn't mean that we have done something to deserve this. We are not the clouds. We are not the suffering. We are the human beings going through this experience. And so I really enjoy that, because as dismal and as dark as suffering can be, I felt like that was a very hopeful way to frame it in a way, because we all experience the pain and the sadness. It's just, you know, recognizing that this is a part of human life, but not letting it attach to us. And so the next part of ACT is, again, identifying our values. What is important? You know, if we spend all of our life avoiding suffering, then when do we have to live? And so with ACT, if we continuously strive to live by our values, we recognize that suffering will come and go, but our life will have meaning. And guided, the committed action is identifying, you know, what actions go with those values. Just like I said earlier, I can say I value my family 10 out of 10, but if I don't have good boundaries between work and home, then am I really living that way? So assign what actions align with those values and live by them, no matter what comes along. And so, no, that's easier said than done. And I recognize that. And reading a book is not going to, we're not going to read the book and be like, oh, I'm never going to, suffering's never going to bother me ever again, because we're all human beings. We all experience suffering. Like, and I know we joke about it, especially through 2020, we've all had our fair share of suffering. And so, you know, when it comes to suffering though, just because it's a part of life doesn't mean that it has to define us or control us, you know, especially if that suffering has come through a religious experience. And a big thing that we talked about again in the last presentation is giving ourselves grace. You know, if we experience these core beliefs that suffering, I'm suffering because I've done something wrong, or we experience these drive for this pathological altruism, give yourself grace as you're setting these boundaries, because it's hard. It's hard to break from those core beliefs. It's hard to set those boundaries. But every time you do it, it gets a little bit easier. And so, again, examining our core beliefs might be a good way to start to challenge some of this suffering as well. This, again, might be helpful with a therapist. But just because we feel like we deserve to suffer, it doesn't mean that it's true. Just because we have that thought or that core belief is ingrained in us, it doesn't mean that it's true. You know, we can challenge these thoughts by focusing on more positive or more helpful thoughts, by focusing on what's important to us, our values, or our loved ones in times of suffering. But again, a therapist might be helpful in this. Again, I'm going to plug the Secular Therapy Project. You don't have to go through this alone. And so in conclusion, suffering is a normal human experience. It can lead to growth, or it can lead to maladaptive beliefs about ourselves. Martyrdom, pathogenic guilt, and pathological altruism can stem from these maladaptive beliefs. But examining our values, our core beliefs, and our boundaries, as well as seeking professional help, may help us to better coexist with suffering.
Amazing. Thank you, Haley. Yeah, that was amazing. I learned a lot about healthy suffering and unhealthy suffering. I feel like I put myself through a lot more suffering than maybe I should, which I think a lot of us can relate to that same feeling, especially in 2020. So thank you for, you know, sharing your knowledge with us about the topic. We definitely do have a few questions. So if it's okay with you, we can just start with, you know, the list of questions that we have.
Oh, of course.
Cool. So the first question that was sent is, how do core beliefs learned early function as almost subconsciously? So what is the process of, you know, of that happening, I guess, in our childhoods? I can only imagine.
Oh, of course. So they can develop through childhood or through stressful experiences. So let's say, I'll start with a stressful experiences first. So let's say that we've had just a traumatic event that might lead us to develop a core belief that the world is unsafe. And so especially from a young age, the research suggests that trauma that happens before the age of 5 is more likely to affect us long-term than trauma that happens afterwards, because we're developing what's called implicit memory rather than explicit memory. So implicit memory is like your feelings for how safe the world is around you. And so if we experience trauma, whether that be physical, verbal, other trauma before the age of five, that might have us develop a core belief unknowingly that the world is unsafe. And so if we grow up with the core belief that the world is unsafe, that might lead to higher anxiety, might lead us to not be as open to new experiences or to connecting with people because we view the world as unsafe. And so stressful experiences can, but also positive experiences. You know, if we've had let's say caregivers who, you know, really use scaffolding, they encourage us to try new things, but they were there for us whenever we made a mistake, we might have the core belief of, no, I'm competent. I can do this. And so that can lead to a healthy development as well. So we have a mixture of positive and negative core beliefs, all of us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Yeah. I'll let Madeline ask the next one because I need to collect a few questions from the chat. I know there's been quite a lot. So Madeline,
yes, the floor is yours. Thank you. So this one is in response to the survey question about how suffering can be helpful, not maybe not necessarily healthy, but this is in relation to, so follow along with me, it's a bit of a wordy question here. So if the point is that we can learn skills to cope with suffering, then we're learning how to get good things in spite of suffering, which would be different from suffering being helpful, which that would imply that you get good things because of suffering. Are you following that logic there?
I think so.
What would be your response to that?
So I think that both are possible. You know, we can have the coping skills to cope with suffering, or we can also have experiences that we can draw strength from. You know, just because we have an event that leads to suffering doesn't mean we're not allowed to suffer or feel upset. Like when we talk about coping skills, we talk about traumatic events, you know, or we talk about, you know, difficult conversations with parents or leaving a religion. Like just because we have all the coping skills, we're like, oh, you have your coping skills. I'm sorry. You can't suffer. No, like we're still able, we're allowed to experience these negative feelings like this suffering. Just the coping skills are just there to help us along the way. So I hope that kind of answer. So both are okay.
It does sound
great.
Yeah. Thank you. Someone else asked if you are aware of any studies about the persecution complex that some religious people have.
So I'm not familiar myself, but if you go on to, so there's a website called ResearchGate, which is where I get a lot of my stuff. So there's a lot of times you can, once you graduate from college, like they cut off your access to research journals. ResearchGate, a lot of clinicians and researchers will post their studies up there for free. So I'm not really familiar with a lot of the research, but that is my go-to place for new research, developing research, and they'll have like categories of researchers as well. So if that's something that you want to learn about, I'm going to learn about it too. Said it was, what was the term? I'm sorry?
Persecution complex.
Persecution complex. So I'm afraid I don't know too much about that, but I'll learn about it.
That's okay. Yeah, I've only heard it in like informal conversations, but it seems to be a thing. So it'd be really nice to see if there's any studies about it.
Yeah, I'd be interested to learn too.
Yeah.
So another question we have is, what if the suffering lasts for years and nothing changes and it's hard to find help?
Well, I always encourage at least seeking out a mental health therapist. You know, like I said, I've had experiences where there's been different periods in my life where I've had therapy and times where I haven't. You know, ever since I was 19. And right now I have a therapist I see at least once a month for the last couple of years. And so if the suffering is lasting for a long time and it's difficult to find meaning or it's dragging us down, I recommend seeking out professional help.
Thank you.
Someone
else asked, how can we cope with suffering if religion isn't there to provide meaning? So is there any techniques that you can share with us?
Yeah. And so for that, I really, really encourage to check out the ACT book, the Russ Harris book, The Happiness Trap. It really talks about finding meaning in life with and without suffering. But also, like I said, kind of if we look at the suffering, and sometimes if we reflect on what brought us through or what skills we've strengthened, I give this metaphor a lot in therapy. And have you ever watched like sword making videos?
No, I think I've seen a couple of like ring making videos, but not swords. No.
So my husband's really into these sword making videos. And so what happens is whenever you're making a sword and someone, I'm going to be really crude whenever I talk about this. I don't know what I'm talking about. I've just seen it on YouTube a few times, but basically you get some metal, you make it really hot, you fold it, you beat the shit out of it. You get it really hot, you melt it down, you fold it, you beat the shit out of it. You get it really hot, you fold it, you beat the shit out of it. And then you do it like over and over again. The more often that you do it, like the stronger your sword is, because if you only did it once, it'd be really brittle. That's what I understand. And so if we think about suffering is that, like, if we never faced any kind of adversity, we would never learn anything. We would never develop any skills, any coping strategies or anything like that. You know, if we were never challenged in school, we would never learn. If we never faced any kind of challenges in the world, we would never learn. Not that people deserve suffering, not that people deserve traumatic experiences that happen. But something that we can do is just reflect on, you know, what brought me through? How the hell did I survive that? How the hell did I survive 2020? How did I make it through, you know, that really difficult year and I lost my job? And so just trying to reflect on what brought us through can sometimes help us to find meaning in it. And again, if we have difficulty with that, sometimes a therapist can be helpful in exploring that.
Perfect. Yeah, thank you. That makes perfect sense.
Thank you. The next one's asking for your thoughts or opinions on Mother Teresa's beliefs and actions regarding suffering.
How much time we got?
We have about half an hour, so feel free.
Oh my gosh. That was okay. I have a podcast episode that basically, not mine, but what basically sums up my beliefs. If you ever listen to the podcast called Swindled, there's a whole episode on Mother Teresa and the basically the use of suffering as a weapon in order to recruit more people to donate to the Catholic Church. And so really recommend that podcast episode, but that was a time whenever suffering was used as a tool for manipulation, pain, and death. Like suffering, not giving medication to people because we want to suffer like Christ did. That is torture. That is straight up torture. And yeah, I really recommend that podcast episode. If you don't know about the horrors of Mother Teresa's time serving for the Catholic Church, I highly recommend listening to that because that is definitely a time whenever suffering was used as a tool for manipulation and for getting donations to the Catholic Church of all places.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, Mother Teresa has been such a interesting character to look into, but definitely problematic, especially in the topic of suffering. So thank you for sharing that podcast. I didn't even know it existed. We'll definitely check it out after. So another question someone asked is, do you give a different definition to pain that you do to suffering? And if you don't, why not?
So pain can be a form of suffering as well. When it comes to things like chronic pain as well, the research suggests that, and not that it takes away all pain and cures ailments or anything like that, but things like mindfulness, the research suggests can be helpful with coping with chronic pain. And so physical pain is a form of suffering. And so the treatments may be different because of course you'll be looking at the medical side as well. But, I've worked with some clients who have been suffering through chronic pain, whether that is through pain or cancer or, you know, other diagnoses. And for them, part of their therapeutic journey is exploring meaning in that. And that's different for every client. Some clients don't want to find meaning in that. They just want to cope with it and go on. But some want to find meaning in that suffering. And, you know, I've worked with non-religious clients who say, you know, I went through a cancer experience and they've wanted to discuss how they've changed as a person. The Alice in Wonderland quote meant a lot to them. I can't go back to yesterday, I was a different person then. And so for them, it was discovering who they are post that diagnosis, post that suffering. And so it's different for everybody if that suffering, pain-wise or chronic illness-wise, is a part of the therapeutic experience, but it can be.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Thank you.
Thank you. I have one other one here. If suffering is helpful in the sense that good can come of it, is that good just a silver lining or looking at the bright side? Or is it some unique advantage that you wouldn't have achieved without the suffering? To say, are you really better than if you hadn't gone through the suffering, or are you just trying to make better or make the most of something because you just can't change it.
Well, as much as I'm a fan of the life of Brian, we can't always look at the bright side of life and make everything better. I don't know.
For sure.
So we make sure I understand the question. So when it comes to suffering and finding meaning, is it just looking through the bright side or is it finding meaning? And then can these skills be developed without the suffering?
Pretty much, yes. That's okay. What I'm getting. That's what I'm getting from it, yes. Thank you.
Okay. And so when it comes to suffering, you know, we can draw meaning from it, but we don't have to have traumatic experiences to become good people. But good people can come from traumatic experiences too. You know, we don't wish for suffering upon anyone. We don't wish for trauma. But those traumatic experiences, just like we talked about, the sky is still there behind the clouds. They don't have to change the person for the worse. You know, you don't have to have these big experiences, but it doesn't mean that we can't draw meaning from them still. I hope that answers the question.
It does, yeah.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Another question that we have is from DAC, the Atheist Community of Discord. And someone there asks, how can we determine whether our boundaries are healthy and how can we reinforce or change our boundaries in the face of pushback from others?
Ooh, good question. So what I always tell people is whenever it comes to boundaries, no, our emotions and our body is kind of like our sixth sense. You know, if I personally feel like a boundary is being violated, it sounds strange, but I feel it in my stomach. I feel reluctance. I feel hesitance. And if a boundary is consistently violated for me, I start to feel almost resentment. And it's not the other person's fault. Like I'm kind of letting that happen in a way. And so for me, my first step, my first cue for myself that a boundary is being violated is I feel it kind of physically. When we look at healthy boundaries, you know, we can look at, I think the first thing is to examine our values. And again, this is general education, not mental health advice, but examine our values, examine if our actions align with those values. So if we say that, no, okay, man, I'm looking at my values. I really value my family first, friends second, humor third, and creativity fourth. No, are we living like that, or are we living like we value work at the top part? And so when it comes to like reflecting on our boundaries, a great metaphor I heard once is boundaries are like a house. And so just because you let someone in your house once, does it mean that they're allowed in all the time? Like if you let a friend come over once, they're not allowed to just walk in and out of your house. If they did, you probably start to resent them after a while, right? If they just walked in like Kramer every day, that wouldn't happen in real life. And so the first time that we set a boundary, the first time that we close that door, we lock that door to our friend can't come in our house anymore, they're going to try and push the door open. They're going to try and push. We have to recognize that anytime we set a boundary for the first time, there's going to be some pushback. That friend might start knocking on our door. They might start jiggling the door handle. They might try to come in through the bathroom window, trying to get into our house. But eventually, if we keep that boundary up, if we say, no, I'm not staying after 5:30 at work, no, you can't borrow my car whenever I have to, you know, go run these errands on Wednesday nights. The longer we kept those boundaries up, the longer we keep that front door closed on our house, eventually that friend will go away and recognize they have to be invited in order to come back. So the biggest thing is whenever we set a boundary, hold firm. Your relationships will be healthier at the end of it. Because, I mean, the longer that we go without setting a boundary and holding firm, the more resentment we hold for that person. And that's not their fault. It's not our fault either. We just have to recognize that that's not a healthy boundary we have in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I love that. We have an RFRX session on boundaries, and I feel like it's so needed. Not just if you are, like, extra religious, you could be a lifelong secular person and still need, like, you know, some help setting boundaries, because it really is really difficult to,
for sure,
especially for like loved ones or work environment situations. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah, family with pushy personalities that we may not want to be alienated from, it's hard.
Those are the ones coming through.
So I have another one. Yeah. Yeah. So I have another one here. For people who disassociate or feel themselves go numb, it can be challenging to sit with suffering long enough to remember the strategies in the moment. So the question is, do you have any tips for educating yourself or the people around you on how to deal with these big feelings as they're happening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I know I've said this a million times. I just want to make sure this is not mental health advice for specific situations. This is just general health advice. But whenever it comes to things like grounding skills or mindfulness skills for staying present, you know, oftentimes what we tell people is to practice them whenever we're calm. We're not experiencing those big feelings. That makes it easier for us to access them when we are experiencing them.
Thank you.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you. Someone else is asking, would acceptance and commitment therapy be effective where someone doesn't have values or recognizes that values aren't inherently meaningful? So, for example, someone who is a nihilist.
That's a good question. And so for that, it might not necessarily align with the belief system. And so if you want to read a little more about it before you check out a therapist to practice it, that's okay. Now, I tell my clients whenever I talk to my clients, my very first session, I talk about exactly what I use. I use cognitive behavioral therapy. I use acceptance commitment therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy. And so those are the treatment methods that I use that I'm most familiar with. And if a client, the homework that's used or the techniques that's used isn't jive, then I'll refer them to someone else. It's okay. Like, you don't have to mesh with every single theoretical orientation. That's why there's so many. But use an evidence-based one. Highly recommend that.
For sure. The most important, I think, piece of advice so they don't just start reading the Bible halfway through.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important.
All right. We're getting down to the last couple of questions now. The next one is, how does implicit memory work?
Ooh, okay. So implicit nexus memory. So implicit memory is, again, how we feel about the world around us. Explicit memory is like episodic memories. So like episodic memories would be like, I remember my first day of the first grade, or I remember slightly my 21st birthday, things like that. So your explicit is your episodic. Your implicit is like the world around you. And so whenever your brain is developing before the age of 5, most of us really don't have a whole lot of memories before the age of 5, might have a few here or there. That's because our brain is kind of hardwiring itself for survival. How safe is my environment? What do I need to do to regulate my emotions? How safe is it to have emotions here? So on and so forth, because we learn so much at such a young age. And so what's developing then is basically just the core of our brain. Now, just because we have trauma at a young age and affects our brain so much, because if we have trauma before the age of 5, it's more likely to affect the amygdala, which is the emotion part of our brain. So those who experience trauma before the age of 5 are more likely to have more hyperactive emotions or more quick to emotional change. But that doesn't mean that that's going to be your trajectory for the rest of your life. That can be unlearned. That can be overcome through coping skills, therapy, medication, all that fun stuff. But before the age of 5, that's whenever those big brain structures are forming to say, okay, well, how active can I be? How safe are these things around me and things? And what kind of coping skills are more helpful for us?
Thank you.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, we have just one last question. So if we have missed any, or if anyone has any additional questions, please do write them now so we have the time to ask. But the last one we have so far is, when religion has defined your boundaries, how do you find balance between pathogenic altruism and excessive selfishness? For example, religion would dictate to honor your parents at all costs. Once you break with religion, how do you find proper balance in fulfilling your parents' whims, needs, and desires?
It's a very good question. And so I think a lot of that takes a lot of self-reflection and, again, identifying what our own personal values are versus the values of the church. There's a worksheet that I do a lot with my teens and my adolescents and young adults, especially those in college, where we identify, okay, what are our parents' values? What are the church's values if they are religious? If they're not, then that's left off. Or what are society's values? What are my school's values? And then at the last, we look at what are our values. And we look at, you know, what is similar and what is different there. And again, values can be everything from family, friends, wealth, creativity, humor, whatever values you can define your own values there. But sometimes just acknowledging what is similar to the values we're given or that were bestowed upon us and what is different can be the helpful first step. But again, a mental health therapist of our own can be helpful with that. And for all of this information, like we have any specifics, you know, really, I know I've said a million times, the Secular Therapy Project has so many awesome therapists, including my own and maybe me, but I really recommend checking out a therapist if you're struggling. Again, anything that I said today is not mental health or medical advice. It's just educational. So really seek out a therapist, man. It's been a great experience for me and I highly recommend it.
I love that as a closing statement. I feel like we could all use a bit of more secular therapy. Oh, we do have a last minute question. So someone is asking, as a secular therapist, do you still engage with spiritual practices?
With what? I'm sorry?
Spiritual practices.
So for me, I do not on a personal level. No, I do a lot of journaling and I read a lot of philosophy and I read a lot. My sister and I got each other the masterclass series for Christmas. And so we've been, I guess, learning and education and taking another perspective has been kind of our own personal journeys ourselves. But I do work with those who are still identify with religious as religious, you know, in my sessions, one of the first questions I ask the intake is, are you religious? No, and some people that they are religious, some people are not, some people that's complicated. But I just want to make sure that in my office that everyone has that ability to express themselves and to process and that it's safe. You know, I've had clients who come in non-religious end up being religious, those who come in religious end up being non-religious, and some who haven't changed. But for me personally, I do not.
Okay.
I just really recommend that ACT book. If I think of any more, I'll shoot you an email, Amaya. I probably should have made a larger resource list. Yeah, it's a really good read too. So.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you all for letting me join you again. Gail, Amaya, Madeline, you guys are awesome. I appreciate you all so much, the hard work that you do. So thank you for the opportunity and thank you all for coming to listen to me again.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.